Jean Barman, Taming Aboriginal Sexuality, Gender, Power, and Race in British Columbia, 1850-1900, in BC Studies of British Columbian Quarterly, numbers 115 and 116, autumn-winter 1997-98, which is a special double issue entitled Native Peoples and Colonialism. The article is being read by the author, Jean Barman. In July 1996, I listened in a Vancouver courtroom as Catholic Bishop Hubert O'Connor defended himself against charges of having raped or indecently assaulted four young Aboriginal women 3 decades earlier. His assertion of ignorance, when asked what one of the complainants had been wearing on the grounds that, to quote him, "As you know, I'm a celibate man," encapsulated his certainty that he had done nothing wrong. He admitted to sexual relations with two of the women, but the inference was clear. They had made him do it. They had dragged him down and led him astray. The temptation exercised by their sexuality was too great for any mere man, even a priest and residential school principal, to resist. I returned home from that day and subsequent days in the courtroom, deeply troubled. I might have been reading any of hundreds of similar accounts written over the past century and more about Aboriginal women in British Columbia. This essay represents my first attempt to come to terms with Bishop O'Connor and his predecessors, made more necessary on reading the National Parole Board's decision of March 1997. The board denied Bishop O'Connor parole, subsequent to his conviction on two of the charges, because, to use the parole board's words, "Your recent psychological assessment indicates that you hold your victims in contempt. At your hearing today, you maintain that you, in fact, were seduced. If I earlier considered that my response to my days in the courtroom might have been exaggerated, I no longer did so. My interest here is not in Bishop O'Connor's guilt or innocence in a court of law, but rather in tracing the lineage of his attitudes in the history of British Columbia. The more I have thought about Bishop O'Connor, the more I realize that those of us who dabble at the edges of Aboriginal history have ourselves been seduced. However much we pretend to read our sources against the grain, to borrow from the cultural theorist Walter Benjamin, we have become entrapped in a partial world that represents itself as the whole world. Records almost wholly male in impetus have been used by mostly male scholars to write about Aboriginal men as if they make up the entirety of Aboriginal people. The assumption that men and male perspectives equate with all persons and perspectives is so accepted it does not even have to be declared. Thus, an American researcher wanting to find out about her Aboriginal counterparts discovered that Indigenous communities had been described and dissected by white men, explorers, traders, missionaries, and scholars, whose observations sometimes revealed more about their own cultural biases than about Native people. Misperceptions of Indian women were rampant because they were held up to the patriarchal model. And this quote is from a book called Messengers of the Wind. So what happens when we turn the past on its head and make our reference point Aboriginal women instead of Aboriginal men? We come face to face with Aboriginal sexuality, or, more accurately, with male perceptions of Aboriginal sexuality. The term sexuality is used here in its sociological sense as, to quote, "the personal and interpersonal expression of those socially constructed qualities, desires, roles, and identities which have to do with sexual behavior and activity, the underlying contention being the social and cultural relativity of norms surrounding sexual behavior and the socio-historical construction of sexual identities and roles." In a useful summary of recent scholarship, English sociologist Gail Hawkes tells us that the word sexuality appeared first in the 19th century, reflecting, to use her words, "the focus of concerns about the social consequences of sexual desire in the context of modernity." End of quote. Christian dogma defines sexual desire, back to Hawkes, as an unreasoned force differentially possessed by women, which threatened the reason of men and the inherent moral supremacy of men, according to Hawks. The backbone of Christian sexuality was the successful promotion of a version of women's sexuality, an ideal of purity and sexual innocence, well fitted to the separation of spheres that underpinned the patriarchal power of the new ruling class. Sexuality, as Hawks contextualizes the term, helps us better to understand the critical years in British Columbia, 1850-1900, when newcomers and Aboriginal peoples came into sustained contact. Everywhere around the world, Indigenous women presented an enormous dilemma to colonizers, at the heart of which lay their sexuality. Initially, historically, solutions were simple and straightforward. During conquest, local women were used for sexual gratification as a matter of course, just as had been, and still are, female victims of war across the centuries. If unspoken, and for the most part unwritten, it was generally accepted that so long as colonial women were absent, Indigenous women could be used to satisfy what were perceived to be natural needs. No scruples existed over what the pioneering scholar of race, Philip Mason, has termed the casual use of a social inferior for sexual pleasure. The growth of settler colonies changed the rules of the game. As anthropologist and historian Anne Laura Stoller astutely observes, drawing from her research on colonial Asia, and I quote, "While the colonies were marked by colonial elites as a domain where colonizing men could indulge their sexual fantasies, these same elites were intent to mark the boundaries of a colonizing population, prevent these men from going native, to curb a proliferating mixed-race population that compromised their claims to superiority and thus the legitimacy of white rule." End of the quote from Stoller. In British Columbia, gender, power, and race came together in a manner that made it possible for men in power to condemn Aboriginal sexuality and at the same time, if they so chose, to use for their own gratification the very women they had turned into sexual objects. While much of what occurred mirrored events elsewhere, some aspects were distinctive. Colonizers in British Columbia never viewed Aboriginal men as sexual threats, whereas attitudes toward women acquired a particular self-righteousness and fervor. The assumptions newcomers brought with them shaped attitudes, which then informed actions. By the mid-19th century, Europeans perceived all female sexual autonomy to be illicit, especially if it occurred in the public sphere, which was considered exclusively male. Aboriginal women in British Columbia not only dared to exercise agency, but often did so publicly, convincing men in power that their sexuality was out of control. The extent that women persisted in managing their own sexual behavior, they were wilded into the savages that many newcomers in any case considered all Indigenous peoples to be. That is, until Aboriginal women acceded to men in power by having their sexuality tamed according to newcomers' precepts, they were for the taking, an equation of agency with sexuality that encourages Aboriginal women's portrayal, even today, as the keepers of tradition. As noted about American anthropological writing, Native women are pictured as unchanging, clinging to a traditional way of life that exists outside the vicissitudes of history. To avoid the image that men like Bishop O'Connor continue to project on them, Aboriginal women have had to be stripped of their agency, past and present. The next section is entitled Prostitution. Indigenous sexuality struck at the very heart of the colonial project. British historian Catherine Hall has termed, in reference to Victorian England, sex as a necessary obligation owed to men, and not one which women were permitted to talk about or think about as owed to themselves. Sexual independence, or circumstances where that possibility existed, was the ultimate threat to the patriarchal family. Children were considered to belong to their fathers, who had to have the assurance that they were indeed his biological heirs. As succinctly summed up by George Stocking in his History of Victorian Anthropology, and I'm quoting from him, If the ideal wife and mother was so pure-hearted as to be utterly ignorant of and adverse to any sexual indulgence, the alternative cultural image of the fallen woman conveys a hint of an underlying preoccupation with the threat of uncontrolled female sexuality. By the time Victoria came to the throne in 1837, I'm quoting again from Stocking, the basic structure of taboos was already defined. The renunciation of all sexual activity save the procreative intercourse of Christian marriage, the education of both sexes in chastity and continence, the secrecy and cultivated ignorance surrounding sex, the bodlerization of literature and euphemistic degradation of language, the general suppression of bodily functions and all the coarser aspects of life. In short, the whole repressive pattern of purity, prudery, and propriety that was to condition sexual behavior for decades to come. Counterpoise to the stereotype were savages, by definition, unrestrained in any sense of delicacy from a co-partnery and sexual enjoyments. And that's the end of the quote from Stocking. Any interpretation of events in British Columbia must adopt the language of colonialism as it was applied to Indigenous women's sexual independence. Around the colonized world, the charge of prostitution, or engaging in a sexual act for remuneration, was used by those who sought to meddle in Indigenous lives. Sexuality was not to be talked about openly, but prostitution and all that it implied could be publicly condemned. In other words, sexuality had to be wilded into prostitution, or possibly concubinage, which is cohabitation outside of marriage, in order for it to be tameable. Hawks traces the fervor over prostitution back to Christianity, which both gave it prominence and held out promise for, and I quote, the redemption of the prostitute, the personification of polluting and uncontrolled women's sexuality. Moving to the 19th century, according to Hawks, Victorian sexual morality was focused on and expressed through the social evil of prostitution. Prostitution was discussed in such diverse venues as popular journalism, serious weekly reviews, medical tracts and publications from evangelical organizations devoted to the rescue of fallen women. Prostitution provided a forum in which to express covertly anxieties about and fascination with the characteristics of women's sexuality. End of the quote from Hawks. No question exists but that Aboriginal people in British Columbia viewed their sexuality differently than did colonizers. It is difficult, if not impossible, to reconstruct gender relations prior to newcomers' arrival, nor is it necessary to do so in order to appreciate the enormity of contact. The scholarship is virtually unanimous in concluding that, traditionally, marriages were arranged, with goods passing to the woman's family. Intrusions of European disease, work patterns, and economic relations unbalanced Aboriginal societies and tended to atomize gender relations. And here, women possessed opportunities for adaptation not available to their male counterparts. Many of the taboos normalized and universalized by Europeans, which we've just talked about, simply did not exist in Aboriginal societies. If for Europeans, sexuality had to be strictly controlled in the interests of assuring paternity, the link may have been less critical for Aboriginal people, and that the group, rather than the immediate biological family, was the principal social unit. To grasp the rapidity with which Aboriginal men became sexualized as prostitutes in colonial British Columbia, it is instructive to go back in time to another bishop, George Hills, who was the first Anglican bishop of Vancouver Island. Arriving in Victoria in June 1860, he encountered a figurative tinderbox. A fur trade village, which in just 20 months had been turned upside down by the gold rush, bringing with it thousands of newcomers from around the world, almost all of them men. Bishop Hills was almost immediately condemning, in his words, the profligate condition of the population. The road to Esquimalt, which is near Victoria, on Sunday is lined with the poor Indian women offering to sell themselves to the white men passing by, and instances are to be seen of open bargaining. Bishop Hill's Methodist counterpart, the missionary Thomas Crosby, who arrived in the spring of 1862, was similarly struck by, to use his words, the awful condition of the Indian women on the streets and lanes of Victoria. What newcomers constructed as prostitution did become widespread during the gold rush, just as it had existed to some extent during the fur trade. The evidence may be largely anecdotal, but it is consistent, and for some times and places overwhelming. Virtually all the descriptions come from a colonial male perspective, but they are so graphic and diverse as to leave little doubt as to the circumstances. The most visible sites that were condemned as locations for prostitution, but in fact may not have been, were seasonal dance halls where for a price miners could while away the long winter evenings, that's the time when they could not be active as miners, by interacting socially with Aboriginal women. A New Westminster resident evoked its, to use her words, squaw dance hall, frequented by miners hastening to throw away their hardly earned gold. Her description is graphic. As soon as 8 or 8:30 struck, the music of a fiddle or two and the tramp of many feet began. Later on, the shouts of drunken men and the screams of squaws in like condition made nights hideous. Each man paid 50 cents for a dance and had to stand drinks at the bar for himself and his dusky partner after each. Bishop Hills described houses where girls, no more than 12, were taken in at night and turned out in the morning like cattle. Even while acknowledging dance hall's contribution to urban economies, the press repeatedly denounced the Aboriginal women whose presence made them possible, as an 1861 editorial charging that prostitution and kindred vices and all of their hideous deformity and disease in every form lurk there. And here, keep in mind, that was a charge, not necessarily the reality. In their San Francisco counterparts, where dance halls had flourished since the gold rush of 1848, the females were at least civilized in that they were white women. But here we have all the savagery of the ancient Ojibways with all the vice of a reckless civilization. And that's a newspaper account. If the decline in the gold rush from the mid-1860s put an end to dance halls' excesses and dampened down excitement over prostitution, the wildness associated with Aboriginal sexuality had permeated settler consciousness. The next section is entitled Female Agency. Turned on their head, contemporary portrayals of Aboriginal women during the gold rush affirm their agency. Agency is by its very nature relational and interactive. Just as occurred earlier during the fur trade and in traditional societies, Aboriginal women both initiated and responded to change. They scooted around. They dared. They're uppity in ways that were completely at odds with Victorian views of gender, power, and race. Some likely soon realized that however much they tried to mimic newcomers' ways, they would never be accepted and so might as well act as they pleased. An Aboriginal woman is said to have dragged the friend of a man who had assaulted her to a nearby police station to be locked up as a witness, only to have him seek, and I quote, protection of the police, which was granted until she left. The jury in a court case against a Victoria policeman accused of, I quote, having attempted to ravish the person of an Indian squaw, was told that the verdict hinged on whether, I quote from the court, you believe the simple evidence of the three Indian women, and after consulting together at one moment, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty. In some cases, Aboriginal women were encouraged or forced by the men in their lives. References abound to fathers selling their daughters for a few blankets or a little gold, and a slave which was worse than death, as charged by missionary Thomas Crosby, exchanges which were likely viewed by some as only continuing traditional marital practices. Yet even missionary accounts hint at female agency, as with Bishop Hill's comments, after unsuccessfully remonstrating with, to use his words, a woman making up a dress for the dance hall that night, poor creatures, they know these things are wrong, but the temptations are too strong. Perhaps the most telling evidence of Aboriginal women's management of their sexual behavior are the numbers who chose to live, at least for a time, if not for a lifetime, with non-Aboriginal men. The nature of some decisions is suggested by Crosby's account of a 12-year-old girl who, having, in his words, refused at first to follow a life of sin, was visited by a great rough fellow who, with his hands full of money and the promises of fine clothes and trinkets and sweets, coaxed her and finally prevailed upon her to come and live with him. Although referring to a later point in time, artist and writer Emily Carr's observations in her memoirs are particularly evocative, as in a conversation between two Aboriginal women whom she almost certainly knew personally. We got a house with 3 rooms and a sink and a kitchen tap. Jacob and Paul go to school with white children. Too bad you've not got a white woman for a husband too, Susan. Aboriginal women caught in the tumultuous world that was a gold rush sometimes had to make hard decisions, whether for material goods or personal safety or out of desire. In such circumstances, a lonely miner's entreaties could be persuasive. Non-Aboriginal men had their own reasons for entering into relationships with Aboriginal women. During the heady years of the gold rush, at least 30,000 white men and several thousand Chinese and blacks sought their fortunes in British Columbia. Most soon departed, for the difficulties of getting to the gold fields were horrendous. But however long they stayed, their utter loneliness in a sea of men cannot be discounted. The most fundamental characteristic of non-Aboriginal women in Gold Rush British Columbia was their paucity. There were very few of them. A Welsh miner reported back to his local cleric how considerable value is placed on a good woman in this country. An Englishman who had already tried his hand in the gold rush in Australia in the early 1850s lamented, "The great curse of a colony, so far as it must always be the curse of any colony where such a want exists, is the absence of women. There must be at least 200 men to every woman. I never saw diggers," which is the California term for gold miners, "so desirous of marrying as those of British Columbia. If it is one thing more than another a miner sighs for after a hard day's work, it is to see either his tent or his log hut brightened up by the smiles of a woman and tidied up by a woman's hand." The miner is not very particular. Plain, fat, and 50 even would not be objected to, while good-looking girls would be the nuggets and prized accordingly. Thus, when a non-Aboriginal man saw an Aboriginal woman, what he may have perceived was not so much her aboriginality as her gender, and certainly her sexuality. Structural factors specific to British Columbia encouraged couplings. At the level of everyday life, Aboriginal people were not nearly so alien as sometimes portrayed, or as they became in the American Pacific Northwest. Relations were generally peaceful, and many miners and settlers survived only because of local largesse. A German visiting the gold fields in 1858 reported, "Many Indians lived in the neighborhood who, on the whole, are on friendly footing with the whites." A guide to prospective settlers published a quarter of a century later asserted, "The intending settler may depend on finding the Indians peaceable, intelligent, eager to learn, and industrious, to a degree unknown elsewhere among the Aborigines of America." Another factor that encouraged unions was ease of communication through common knowledge of the Chinook trading jargon. Containing about 600 words and a large variety of nonverbal additions, Chinook facilitated conversations across the races. People could talk to each other on an ongoing basis, and sometimes they did more than talk. Although some of the relationships spawned by the gold rush extended through the couple's lifetimes, many were fairly transient. Two persons would cohabit for a time until one or the other decided to move on. In most cases, it was a man who did so. As one Aboriginal woman recalled, "Oh, it was hard on Indian wives, I guess, but they always managed to raise their children, even if their husbands finished with them." Women might end relationships, as in the gold rush town of Lytton in 1868, when a man, to quote, "lately left by his Indian wife, who had had two children by him, confesses having sown the seed he has reaped." Other women simply ensured that their husbands knew that they could leave if they wished to do so. An early novel by Frances Herring, who arrived during the gold rush, depicted a saloon keeper with a squaw wife named Desdemona, whose independent character drew on the author's many years in British Columbia. Let me quote from it. "All who know the habits of the squaws married to white men, especially if they lived in one of the towns, will remember the overmastering desire they occasionally developed for a return to their tribe and a resumption of their old life for at least a time, to fish all night from a light cedar canoe with no thoughts of the white man's scorn, to pick berries, cut and dry fish until their garments were saturated with the odor of salmon, gather roots, herbs, and the bark of trees for baskets, the rushes also for clisclis or mats, to extract the beautiful and durable reds and blues from certain plants and berries for dyes, and generally to revel in God's great temple of nature." So it was with Desdemona. One of these calls from the wild had taken Desdemona, and when her Tenasticoop man, small white man in Chinook, came in one night, the house was dark, and she and the children gone. She had stepped into a canoe, paddled across the wide Fraser River and up the Salmon Stream, and only when it suited her fancy did she return home to her husband. And that is from Frances Herring's book called Nan and Other Pioneer Women of the West. The various data from personal accounts, church records, and the manuscripts of census suggest that in those areas of British Columbia opened up to Europeans during the Gold Rush years, but 1 in 10 Aboriginal women cohabited at some point in her life with a non-Aboriginal man. The prevalence of such unions even caused the first session of the new provincial legislature, following entry in the Confederation in 1871, to pass a bill, which was subsequently disallowed by the federal government, to legitimize children of unions between Aboriginal women and non-Aboriginal men whose parents wed subsequent to their birth rather than before it. The next section is called Taming Aboriginal Sexuality, which is the title of the entire article. By the time British Columbia became a Canadian province in 1871, Aboriginal women had been almost fully sexualized. The perception of widespread prostitution, and if not prostitution, then concubinage, or living together outside of marriage, gave men in power the freedom to speak openly about matters that otherwise would have been only whispered. Newcomers took for granted the fall as depicted in the Bible. Human nature was weak, and the biological man could easily be tempted to evil by his female counterpart, just as Bishop O'Connor considers himself to have been a century later. It was woman's place to be docile and subservient so as not to provoke man. For all of those seeking to control Aboriginal peoples, women who exercised sexual autonomy had to be subdued. Conversion to Christianity held the key. For, to quote Thomas Crosby again, woman was always a slave or burden bearer until the gospel came and lifted her into her true social position, which was essentially as man's handmaiden. Whether missionaries, government officials, or Aboriginal men, the common perception was that the only good Aboriginal woman was a woman who stayed home within the bosom of her family. So an informal alliance developed between these three groups, missionaries, government officials, and Aboriginal men, to refashion Aboriginal women. This tripart alliance, whereas men in power buttressed and comforted each other, was grounded in mutual expediency and, to some extent, in mutual male admiration. With entry into Confederation, responsibility for Aboriginal people shifted to the federal government under the terms of the British North America Act. And it did not take long for newly appointed government officials to realize the enormous benefit to be had from establishing cordial relations with missionaries, for they were already at work across much of the sprawling province. Officially, missionaries had no status, but unofficially they became the government's foot soldiers and its eyes and ears. Aboriginal policy, as it developed in British Columbia, was to minimize official involvement in everyday affairs, which effectively meant letting missionaries have a free hand. If disagreeing in many areas, including Aboriginal people's right to an adequate land base, government officials repeatedly commended missionaries for having, to quote from one of them, taught above all the female portion of the community to behave themselves in a modest and virtuous manner. The other prong of the alliance crossed racial boundaries in the interests of gender solidarity and mutual self-interest. Members of an Indian Reserve Commission that was active across British Columbia in the mid-1870s left an extensive paper trail and repeatedly expressed approval of, to use their words, Aboriginal manliness and of the industry of the men. Similarly, in missionary accounts, it is almost wholly Aboriginal men who are given individuality and personality. Men, particularly those who emulated colonial ways, needed to have suitable spouses, and for this reason, too, Aboriginal women had to have their sexuality tamed. As for Aboriginal men, they were likely motivated by a shortage of women, and also for some of them by a desire to please their colonial mentors. Reports of a shortage were sufficiently widespread to be convincing. As early as 1860, Anglican Bishop Hills observed a scarcity of wives, among the northern Tsimshian, many of whose members camped in Victoria on a seasonal basis. The Indian Reserve Commission of the mid-1870s created a census, which counted 1,919 Aboriginal persons in the area of British Columbia extending from Burrard Inlet north to Jervis Inlet, across to Comox on Vancouver Island, and north through the Saanich Peninsula, including the Gulf Islands. Of these 1,919 Aboriginal persons, 979 were adult males, compared with only 919 adult females, and 94 were male youth, compared with only 84 female youth. The enumerator of the Southern Interior, extending from Lytton through the Nicola Valley, counted 884 adult males, compared with 803 adult females, and lamented, and I quote, the absence of females, both adults and youth, those who should have been the future mothers of the tribe. Some Aboriginal men, in effect, made deals to behave in accord with missionary aspirations for them in exchange for getting wives. Crosby described a visit to a village on the Queen Charlotte Islands in about 1885, where local men promised him, "Sir, if you will come and give us a teacher, we will stop going to Victoria. Victoria has been the place of death and destruction to our people. As you see, we have no children left to us. All our young women are gone. Some of our young men can't find wives anymore, and we wish that you could help them to get wives among the Tsimshian people." The tripart campaign to tame the wild that was represented by Aboriginal sexuality had two principal goals. The first goal was to return Aboriginal women home. The second goal was to desexualize Aboriginal everyday life, in effect to cleanse it so that the home to which women returned would emulate its white colonial counterpart. Now, the first of these two goals, returning Aboriginal women home. Marriage lay at the heart of newcomers' morality. And as anthropologist George Stocking concludes, quote from him again, "It is perfectly clear that marriage proper meant proper Victorian marriage, whose purpose was to control human and especially female sexuality, so that there might be certainty of male parentage. As summed up by English historians Leonore Davidoff and Catherine Hall for England between the late 18th and mid-19th centuries, marriage was the economic and social building block for the middle class. Marriage became both symbol and institution of women's containment. It was marriage which would safely domesticate the burgeoning gardening flower into an indoor pot plant. The beautiful object potentially open to all men's gaze became the possession of one man when kept within the house like a picture fixed to the wall." And that's the end of the quote from Davidoff and Hall. In theory, two marital strategies could have tamed Aboriginal sexuality. The first was to encourage non-Aboriginal men to wed their Aboriginal partners, and the second was to return Aboriginal women home to wed Aboriginal men. Either would have satisfied Victorian notions of marriage, but the alliance of interest that existed among men in power combined with growing racism to ensure that the second option would be favored. As early as 1873, an agitated provincial official pointed to the federal government's responsibility for, and I quote, "the care and protection of the native races in this province. And so long as this shameful condition of things is suffered to continue unchecked, the character of that race in the social scale is practically a delusion." Reserve commissioners reported on conversations with chiefs in Nanaimo where, I quote, "the evil a concubinage of their young women with the white men around were especially pointed out." By 1884, an Indian agent, and these are the men that the federal government appointed to be responsible for Indians in different areas of the province. By 1884, an Indian agent with an Aboriginal wife and grown daughters felt able to argue, and I think here with a touch of self-interest, that, and I quote, "with the present state of civilization in the country and the abundance of white and educated half-breed women, i.e. like his daughters, such a practice should be put a stop to in future. Aboriginal women were needed at home to service their menfolk." For men in power, gender and race neatly dovetailed. Within the mix of pseudoscientific ideas that are associated with social Darwinism, which at that point was at its height, newcomers accepted as seemingly demonstrated by the triumph of colonialism and technological advances, that mankind had evolved into a hierarchy with whites, very conveniently, at the top and Aboriginal people near the bottom. Persons of mixed race ranked even lower, for to quote from a colonial visitor, "Half-breeds, as a rule, inherit, I am afraid, the vices of both races." Concerns grew in British Columbia over, I quote, "a class of half-breed children who, under the bond of illegitimacy and deprived of all incentives in every respect, will in course of time become dangerous members of the community." During the late 1870s, such fears were exacerbated by the murderous rampage by the young sons of a Hudson's Bay trader, i.e., the McLean family, and given a sexual edge by female mixed-race students at a public boarding school at Cache Creek, becoming pregnant by their male counterparts. While some encouragement was given to non-Aboriginal men to marry Aboriginal women with whom they were cohabiting, this was, for the most part, done somewhat grudgingly. Petitions became a favored manner to compel Aboriginal women home. The Tripartite Alliance developed a dynamic whereby Aboriginal men who were illiterate signed petitions with their ex for their name that had been orchestrated by missionaries who then dispatched them to government officials to justify their taking action. Both Catholic and Protestant missionaries participated, as did Aboriginal men across much of the province and numerous officials at various levels of government. In 1885, Oblate missionaries, who were the principal Catholic missionaries across the province of British Columbia, stage-managed two identical petitions to the Canadian Governor-General in Ottawa that were affirmed with their marks by 962 Aboriginal men, including at least 18 chiefs from across the Cariboo and south to the lower Fraser Valley. And the best English prose of petitions, and I quote, "beg to lay before your excellency that a great evil is springing up amongst our people, whereas on a dispute between a married couple, the wife leaves her husband and goes off the reservation and takes up with a bad white man, Chinaman, or other Indian, and they live together in an unlawful state." The Aboriginal men who were signing the petition with their exes sought permission to bring back the erring ones by force if necessary. Caught up in the rhetoric to tame Aboriginal sexuality, the Federal Ministry of Justice drafted an even broader regulation for consideration by the chiefs, one of which made it possible, and I quote, "to bring back to the reserve any Indian woman who has left the reserve and is living immorally with any person off the reserve." The proposal was only derailed by the Federal Ministry of Justice's suggestion, made almost in passing, that the Federal Department of Indian Affairs should, and I quote, "consider before it is passed whether or not the putting of it in a force will lead to riots and difficulties between the Indians and the white people and others with whom the Indian women are said to be living immorally." Three of the four British Columbia Indian agents consulted considered that this might well happen were chiefs given such authority. One of them acknowledged female agency in its observation that, let me quote, "while in some cases the Indian women might be brought back without trouble, it would be impossible to keep them on a reserve against their will." The project was shelved, even though the Catholic Bishop of New Westminster intervened directly at the federal level in an attempt to bypass the bureaucrats. The campaign to tame Aboriginal sexuality was not to be thwarted. The Oblates were almost certainly behind a bolder petition dispatched in 1890 to the Canadian Governor General. The chiefs of 58 bands, again extending from the Cariboo through the Fraser Valley, indicated by their marks that they were, and I quote, "much aggrieved and annoyed by the fact that our wives, sisters, and daughters are frequently decoyed away from the reserve by ill-designing persons. No means existed to return these erring women, but even were this possible, in most cases these women are induced to return again to their seducers. Fearing that some of our young men who are sufferers will certainly take the law into their own hands and revenge themselves on the offending parties, the petition sought, I quote, a law authorizing the infliction of corporal punishment by the lash. The advisability of legislation making an offense for a white man to have sexual intercourse with an Indian woman or girl without Christian marriage was referred to the Federal Ministry of Justice. which in this case pulled the plug. The ministry considered the legislation unnecessary since, and I quote, the laws relating to protection of females and for the punishment of persons who seduce or abduct them apply to Indian women as well as to white women. Yet the campaign persisted, and later in 1890, the Indian agent at Lillooet urged, on behalf of the chiefs of the numerous bands around here, and remember that every chief is a man by definition, that a severe penalty should be imposed upon any person, not an Indian, who harboring an Indian woman does not deliver her up to the chief of the reserve. At this point, the enthusiasts stumbled. Acting largely independently of civil authority, the Oblates had allied themselves across much of the interior with local Aboriginal men in order to effect control over everyday life. As one Indian agent noted in the early 1890s, although the flogging habit has been abandoned for some years past and fines are not so common as they once were, considerable sums of money are annually collected by the chiefs and their watchmen for the benefit of churches whose functionaries attend to their spiritual welfare. And so it was in the spring of 1892, the Oblate missionary at Lillooet, the chief, and four other Aboriginal men were brought before the local magistrate. They were convicted and actually given jail sentences for, and I quote, flogging a young girl and the report only of a fourth party for some unspecified sexual activity. Without investigation, he, the priest, ordered 15 lashes. His plea was, first of all, ancient customs of the Indians, and secondly, necessity for such a punishment in order to suppress immorality. It's the end of the quote. The Indian agent who made the report considered both that the ancient custom was not as portrayed by the missionary, and that the local men should not have been punished as severely as was the priest, since they believed the priest to their commander in all church matters, and consequently they were obliged to obey him. The incident appears to have cooled the alliance between the Oblates and local men, who were, and I quote, astonished at the extent of the jurisdiction of the courts of law, when even the dictates of a priest should be upset and the priest himself held accountable. The Protestants could be just as enthusiastic as the Catholics in allying themselves with local Aboriginal men to keep women at home and in calling on federal officials to enforce what they could not effect by their own devices. In 1889, the Indian agent at Alert Bay on northern Vancouver Island, acting in concert with the local Anglican missionary, stopped a group of women from boarding a steamer to Victoria. His justification was that they, and I quote, went with the avowed purpose of prostituting themselves, and he, quote, had previously been requested by numbers of young men to prevent, if possible, their wives and sisters from going to Victoria. Reflecting the Tripart Alliance's perspective, the Indian agent considered nearly all of the young women, whether they leave their homes, whether it is ostensibly for working at the canneries or at the hop fields, they leave with the ultimate idea of making money by prostitution. The steamboat company vigorously protested, and the provincial Indian superintendent was lukewarm to the action, astutely observing that the Indian women, their friends, come to Victoria and other places in their own canoes, making their restriction practically impossible. Nonetheless, the Indian agent and Anglican missionary did such a successful end run to federal officials as to persuade them to propose legislation to keep at home by force if necessary, and I quote, Indian women from the west coast of British Columbia who are in the habit of leaving their villages and reserves by steamers and by other modes of transportation with the object of visiting the cities and towns of that province for immoral purposes. The proposed legislation hit a snag only after the Federal Minister of Justice indicated, I quote, there is not at present sufficient material on hand to permit the drawing up of a bill fully dealing with the question. The minister requested the provincial superintendent of Indian Affairs to circularize Indian agents around the province. Even though the agents would likely have found it far easier to acquiesce to the demands than to dispute them, they were all, apart from those at Alert Bay and Babine on the northern interior, remarkably sanguine. On the west coast of Vancouver Island, I do not know of a single instance on this coast where a young woman has been taken to Victoria or elsewhere for the purposes of prostitution. His neighbor, I am not aware of any Indian woman belonging to the Cowichan Agency who leaves this reservation for immoral purposes. In the Fraser Valley and Lower Mainland, there are very few immoral women. in the central interior, the practice of Indian women leaving the reserves for the purposes of leading immoral lives is not common in this agency. The Southern Interior's agent offered a general observation. Indians are in their nature, in consequence of their training, habits, and surroundings, far less virtuous than the average whites. Their morality should not, therefore, be judged by the standards of the white people. The Indian woman, although, as above stated, inclined to be worst in her morals, is naturally modest. The North Coast agent considered, the Indians have learned from sad experience the effects of immorality in the cities and are rapidly improving their conduct. Summarizing the responses, Provincial Superintendent of Indian Affairs concluded, very few Indian women who may be found living in an immoral life in our cities and towns, and they are less in number as a rule than their white sisters. Nonetheless, the depiction of Aboriginal sexuality as out of control was too attractive an explanation for missionaries and government failings to be abandoned. Just 3 years later, in 1895, a petition signed by 34 men from central Vancouver Island, all but one with their marks indicating they were illiterate, demanded legislation to prevent, and I quote from the petition, our wives and daughters and sisters from being carried to Victoria for illegitimate purposes. The British Columbia federal senator to whom the petition was addressed took its claims at face value and demanded that steps be taken to prevent the deportation of Indian women, seeing that, as he said, Indians are wards of the government under tutelage and are not qualified to manage their own affairs wisely. The federal senator, who simply assumed that Aboriginal women's sole role was to service their menfolk, emphasized that an increase instead of a decrease is much to be desired in the Aboriginal population. The federal response is interesting because rather than quoting from the Indian agent's reports in their files, officials emphasize the difficulties of securing legislation. In doing so, they reveal, perhaps inadvertently, that women were de facto having their travel restricted by local Indian agents, and I quote, when requested by the husband or brother or anyone having proper authority to stop a woman from going away. And so the men have the prevention of what they complain almost entirely in their hands. In effect, it was already going on without laws. The sexualization of Aboriginal women had far less to do with reality, therefore, than with the needs and desires of men in power. So long as settler society perceived a need to tame Aboriginal sexuality, men in power could reorder Aboriginal society with impunity. Now on the second goal, which was reordering Aboriginal society. Over time, virtually every aspect of Aboriginal everyday life acquired a sexual dimension, thereby justifying its reordering. Aboriginal sexuality, perhaps more accurately, the fear of Aboriginal women's agency, became a lens through which traditional preferences in housing, social institutions, and childcare were critiqued and found wanting. The rhetoric condemning housing, in particular the big houses cohabited by coastal peoples, made explicit Victorian fears of the body and of human sexuality. This rhetoric also reflected social Darwinian notions of the hierarchy of the species, at the top of which lay Western societies premised on the monogamous conjugal family. The very existence of sites where more than a single family might live together was equated with immorality. No doubt existed but that, given the opportunity, men and women would act on their impulses. David Duff and Hall have linked the subordination of women to the private home. Let me quote from them. Women had been created for men, indeed for one man, and there was a necessary inference from this that home was a proper scene of a woman's action and influence. The idea of a privatized home separated from the world had a powerful moral force, and if women, with their special aptitude for faith, could be contained within that home, then a space could be created for true family religion. And so it was also in British Columbia. The single-family home came to be seen as a necessary prelude to Christian conversion. Men in power repeatedly lauded the single-family home, as in side notes on the Reserve Commission census of Aboriginal people taken in the mid-1870s. At Burrard Inlet, the houses in this place have a pleasing appearance when viewed from the sea. They are mostly of the cottage style, in other words, single-family style, whitewashed and kept cleaner at this than is usual with most Indians. In contrast, along the Fraser River, most of the houses of this tribe are of the primitive style. There are, however, several cottages kept and fitted up in a neat manner. At Cowichan on Vancouver Island, there are a few tidy cottages. What they require is a desire and encouragement. Missionaries like Thomas Crosby were even more fervent and repeatedly linked housing to sexuality. The old heathen house, from its very character, was the hotbed of vice. Fancy a great barn-like building, occupied by as many as a dozen families, only separated from each other by low partitions. The interior seemed made for naughty deeds. As Crosby put it, picture such a building with no floor other than the ground, no entrance for light except the door when open, and the cracks in the walls and the roof. Around the inside of such a building were ranged the beds made up of rude platforms. Is it any wonder that disease and vice flourish under such favorable surroundings? In sharp contrast for Crosby stood the Christian home. Crosby considered that, I quote again, the only way to win the savage from his lazy habits, sin, and misery is to be able and willing to show them how to build a nice little home from the foundation to the last shingle on the roof. Fear of Aboriginal sexuality became frenzied in the rhetoric around the institution of the potlatch, which was an institution used to redistribute wealth and celebrate important times in the life cycle. Missionaries led the campaign against a social activity that was practiced across most of the province, garnering support from government officials and over time from some converted Aboriginal men. Initially, arguments against the potlatch focused on it being demoralizing, leading to debauchery. Federal legislation banning the potlatch took effect at the beginning of 1885, due largely to missionary activity, but did not bring about wholesale conversion to Christianity. Missionaries soon sought both allies and Aboriginal men in search of wives and reasons apart from themselves as missionaries to explain their failure to live up to their expectations that they had put on themselves. The Canadian ethnographer Marius Barbeau concluded in 1921, after examining federal files on the potlatch, that as the church has not succeeded in making converts to any material extent, there must be found a scapegoat. And as the potlatch already had a bad name, it was blamed. The sexualization of the potlatch had a number of components, but centered on the supposed sale of Aboriginal women as wives or prostitutes to gain the money to potlatch. In 1893, a Toronto newspaper reported that a group of British Columbia missionaries had witnessed, I quote, blankets for potlatch procured at the expense of the virtue of women, an event which the local Indian agent determined afterwards was sensationalized. By the end of the century, the press is convinced, I quote from one of the articles, the potlatch is the inciting cause of three-fourths of the immorality that exists among Indian women. Writing shortly thereafter, the Indian agent Alert Bay asserted that the younger generation of Aboriginal men supported his attempt to persuade his superiors in Ottawa to act against potlatching. It looks cruel to me to see a child 13 or 14 years of age put up and sold just like sheep or a nanny goat to a bleary-eyed Siwash, a Chinook word for an Indian, to a bleary-eyed Siwash old enough to be her grandfather for a pile of dirty blankets, which will in turn be potlatched to the rest of the band and all to make the proud father a big Injun, spelled I-N-J-U-N, which was a slang term of the day, rather than, to quote, to let her marry a young man who I'm sure she wanted. The Indian agent quoted a longtime missionary to make his point that the girls die off and the young men, for the most part, cannot get wives because, as a rule, they have no blankets of money unless they are sons of chiefs, and the others cannot get wives until they are able to command a certain sum, which is so difficult as they have to compete with the older men who hold the property. The unwillingness to tolerate Aboriginal women's agency was a major factor, not just in these events, but in the determination to replace familial child care with residential schools operated by missionaries under loose government oversight. As attested by the scholarship, schools sought total control over pupils' sexuality, particularly that of girls. The twin concepts of Christian marriage and the Christian home depended on young women remaining sufficiently unblemished so that they could become good wives according to Victorian standards of behavior. The attitudes and actions of Thomas Crosby and his wife Emma are instructive. Crosby considered that parents, quote, though kind and indulgent to their children, are not capable of teaching and controlling them properly. Something must be done to save and protect the young girls from being sold into the vilest of slavery. On account of the prevalence of this traffic of Indian girls, many of the early missionaries were led to establish girls' homes for the rescue and further protection of these poor victims of this awful system. It's the end of the quote from Thomas Crosby. The taming that went on in the schools, in the girls' school that the Crosbys established, as in residential schools across the province, left no doubt as to Aboriginal agency. As remembered by a Crosby school matron in the early 1880s, the girls required a great deal of grace, patience, and determination. They were so obstinate and disobedient. The wildness associated with Aboriginal sexuality explains attitudes toward a girl's transition from pupil to wife. Reflecting the assumptions of the day, the superintendent of the Children's Aid Society in Vancouver expressed relief that, and I quote, the savage was so thin and washed out of two young women of mixed race that they were able to find happiness with their white lovers. Yet this represented only, in their view, only a glimmer of light in the darkness. According to Crosby's biographer, girls stayed in the home till they were married or which time a new girl should be admitted. The full extent of missionaries' distrust of their charges is evident in the musings of another Crosby matron regarding the potential marriage of a 14-year-old student. It would seem sinful to allow such things to be mentioned if they were white girls, but here they are safer when married young. Again, the informal alliance operated. Schools measure their success by the number of girls who have, to quote from a missionary, who have married Christian Indians, have helped to build up Christian homes, to civilize the people generally, and to aid in developing their own neighborhood. Instead of a young man with his friends going with property and buying a wife, as was done formerly, many of our brightest young men tried to make the acquaintance of the girls in the home. Women might no longer be sold by their fathers, but they were no less commodities when it came to marriage. The Crosbys, like other missionaries, put a romantic spin around what was in effect a good being made available to a handful of men considered suitably Christian. Let me quote again from Thomas Crosby. There was no doubt in our minds that real, true love again and again developed between the young men who thus became acquainted. This acquaintance finally resulted in their marriage and the happy life that followed. The last section is called Consequences. By the end of the 19th century, settler society took for granted the interpretation that men in power put on Aboriginal women's agency. The ongoing frenzy over the potlatch is indicative. The press became ever more determined to expose its supposed basis in Aboriginal sexuality. An article entitled Indian Girl Sold for 1,000 Blankets hit Vancouver streets in 1906. The story makes clear that the supposed revelation about the awful Indian practice of potlatch originated with an Anglican missionary who was disgruntled because a pupil had married someone other than the man he had selected for her. Later in the year, both Vancouver and Ottawa newspapers trumpeted the headline, Five Indian Girls Sold. A report on investigation, like the others, proved to be groundless. A Vancouver paper headlined a year later, Squaw Sold for $400 at Alert Bay to Grizzled Chief from Queen Charlotte's. It turned out that while two marriages had occurred, neither involved a Grizzled Chief, and the local Indian agent considered the article to be very misleading. The press coverage, though, prompted a host of women's voluntary associations across the country to demand legislation to, and I quote, put an end to this great blot on the civilization and Christianity of Canada. Writing in 1921, a barrister who was the son of the former Indian agent at Alert Bay and who represented Aboriginal people opposed to the potlatch ban considered that, I quote, "The strongest reason for enforcing the law against the potlatch is a question of Indian marriages. It is also contended that women were bought and sold, but this was not true. Had the potlatch not been so successfully sexualized, it is doubtful that opponents could have maintained its illegality into the mid-20th century. The taming of Aboriginal sexuality became a means to an end, as well, of course, as an end in itself, but the effects were no less detrimental to Aboriginal women. For Aboriginal women, the consequences of the ceaseless rhetoric of scorn heaped on them in the interests of men in power were enormous. Some women acquiesced and returned or remained at home, and the Crosby delighted, to quote from Thomas, on visiting around among the villages to pick out those Christian mothers who had the privilege of the home life and training at our school. In a broad sense, Aboriginal societies did come to mimic their colonial counterparts, which is not unexpected given federal policies and the material advantages to be got from doing so. An Aboriginal informant explained in 1950 how, we quote, "converts were sometimes termed made white men as they used different types of houses and they dressed in white men's clothes while their heathen brothers indulged in all the old rituals." Some women had the decision taken out of their hands. As more marriageable white women became available and attitudes hardened, numerous non-Aboriginal men shed their Aboriginal partners. The manuscript census of the late 19th century indicate that while some of these women did return home and enter into new unions with Aboriginal men, others scraped along at the edges of settler society. Other Aboriginal women continued to dare. Many interracial unions survived the campaign to tame Aboriginal sexuality, in some cases by the partners legally married or retreating outward into the frontier or by simply standing their ground. The encouragement that missionaries and government officials gave to Aboriginal men may have caused some women to disengage from their home communities in search of more satisfying life opportunities. To the extent that traditional patterns of gender relations gave way to male mimicry of European practices, so the social distance between the sexes may have widened. Women still married out, as indicated by the 1901 and 1911 manuscript censuses, and evoked in an Emily Carr vignette about a woman who had, to use Carr's words, married white and both loved her husband and gloried in his name, for it's infinitely finer to be Mrs. Jenny Smith than have her name hitched to an Indian man's and be Jenny Joe or Jenny Tom. Most importantly, the campaign to tame Aboriginal sexuality so profoundly sexualized Aboriginal women that they're rarely permitted any other form of identity. Not just Aboriginal women, but Aboriginal women's agency was sexualized. In the extreme case, their every act became perceived as a sexual act, and because of the unceasing portrayal of their sexuality as wild and out of control, as an act of provocation. By default, Aboriginal women were prostitutes, or at best, potential concubines. Their activities were imbued with the intent that men in power had so assiduously ascribed to them, thus vitiating any responsibility for their or other men's actions toward them. Sexualization of Aboriginal women's agency occurred within a context in which they were already doubly inferior by virtue of their gender and race, thus virtually ensuring that any Aboriginal woman who dared would become colonialism's plaything. Again, the stories are legion, be it the Okanagan Valley in the 1880s, Vancouver Island in the 1920s, the North Coast in the 1960s, or Bishop O'Connor. Sometimes the accounts embody a strong element of bravado, in other cases a wish fulfillment of lonely men, then yet others a strong dose of action, as with O'Connor. A young Englishman who arrived in the Okanagan Valley shortly after the completion of the Transcontinental Railway in 1886 exemplified a generation of newcomers who took for granted Aboriginal women's sexualization. Let me quote from him. This comes from C.W. Holliday, The Valley of Youth. "Most of these women were graceful, some even pretty. Clear, light bronze skins with just a touch of color in the cheeks, even teeth, and glossy jet black hair that had almost a tinge of blue in it. Their black eyes would be modestly cast down in the present men, and sometimes a shy upward glance of coquetry, but not if there were any bucks, which is a pejorative term for Indian men, not if there were any bucks in sight. He recalled a contemporary who, and I quote, fed up with batching, had disturbed the monastic peace of the community by taking onto himself a dusky mistress. The sexualization of Aboriginal women's agency removed any sense of responsibility for him. Even as his friends were deciding whether to be jealous, and I quote, he and his lady had a bad row, and realizing that his little romance was ended, he fired her out. But as none of the rest of the old boys were gallant enough to take a chance on her, the lady returned to the bosom of her tribe, and once more there was peace on earth in the little community. Even persons who supported Aboriginal people, as did a lawyer representing them in the 1920s against the potlatch, persisted in seeing women in sexual terms, considering that, and I quote, contact between Indians and loggers had always been fraught with dire results, particularly to the Indian women. This assessment was in sharp contrast to his view of Aboriginal men, and this is the same lawyer. The Indian man in his own environment is a man of dignity, big and venerable. And here you see gender interacting with race. Now, in the next example, in a general sympathetic account of a summer sojourn in 1966 at Telegraph Creek on the North Coast, a young American made clear that Aboriginal women's agency remained sexualized. I quote, more than they would have in the old days, I'm sure they make fun of the Indians to me for their limber-limbed promiscuity. A friend eats supper with me, chatting about the morals of the Indian girls. No morals at all if you scratch their stomachs a minute, he says. Now, this comes from Edward Hoagland, notes from the century before, who describes how their every action became a sexual action. Thus, he gives this vignette, how earlier in the spring, a girl appeared in the store, sent by her parents, and took up the broom and began to sweep after the historical fashion of a squaw proposing to a young man. And for young Hoagland, the wild which was Aboriginal sexuality remained mythic, noting that in New York, to dream of a woman is an unremarkable event, but here invests the whole night with sexual urgency. And so he repeatedly found himself tempted. I've had a day hearing stories of Indian women being mounted and screwed. He resisted, but precisely because he did accept the equation of Aboriginal female sexuality, Let me quote, of course these Indian girls are too vulnerable to fool with, so I have only the past to keep me company in bed. And here we come full circle to Bishop O'Connor. At virtually the same time that this young American was fantasizing but not acting, Bishop O'Connor acted on his impulses. Like so many men before him, he still considers himself to have been, I quote from his trial, seduced, and a full generation later remains in his heart, and I quote, a celibate man. I have no doubt that Bishop O'Connor feels himself to be sincere, just as I have no doubt of the importance of newcomers' construction of Aboriginal women's sexuality for understanding events during that critical half-century, 1850-1900, when your, my, and Bishop O'Connor's British Columbia came into being.